In very general terms, Cervantes and Shakespeare, who died practically at the same time, everybody knows they are regarded as the most important writers, Western authors, probably since Dante. Maybe if we could start with a very general outline of what is it that makes these two authors stand in this separate, unmatched category? Why are they regarded as such, regardless of all the great authors that followed them? I don't know, be it Goethe or Proust or Joyce or Dostoevsky or I don't know how many others.
I think the unique characteristics of Shakespeare and Cervantes have to do with the fact that they managed to find a way to speak in a modern voice to modern readers. Now, many of us modern readers, contemporary readers, would say they perhaps don't sound very modern to us. But especially if you compare them to what preceded them, major writers such as Dante and Petrarch, both Shakespeare and Cervantes are recognizably the first major modern writers who are speaking about the same kinds of concerns that animate people now. They're focused on this world rather than the hereafter. They're focused on questions of politics, gender, society, as well as the nature of art itself. And by changing the focus of literature to those kinds of present-day concerns and issues that present-day readers would recognize, well, in Cervantes' case, he gives us the first novel, Don Quixote, and in Shakespeare's case, he gives us 37 or so plays that that we can never stop performing and reading. And so they really stand apart from everybody else that preceded them in that way.
These authors are most commonly seen as their texts reflecting the spirit of the late Renaissance. But at the same time, yeah, their works are seen as the last great examples of pre-modern Western culture, or also the inaugurators of modernity and even somehow prophets of post-modernity in the ways in which Shakespeare's plays do not have a single voice. They offer different perspectives, how he anticipates psychology and even psychoanalysis with these long monologues and so on. And Cervantes, of course, writing his books about books and characters, playing other characters. Is it possible to place these figures and their works, like classify them somehow in a linear history, historical epochs, or are they so big that this is not possible?
I think both Cervantes and Shakespeare have to be seen both in their immediate historical context as Renaissance writers and as figures that transcend that moment. And I don't think we have a choice. I think it's, first of all, for scholars, we inevitably look at them as products of the Renaissance, both products and makers of the Renaissance, because they are clearly shaped by the environment that they are in intellectually, artistically, economically, and so forth. They're clearly completely embedded in their moment. And for scholars, that tends to be the first thing we say about them, is because we use them as a way of understanding the period and vice versa. But at the same time, they stand out from their period. And it's one of the functions of great literature in our culture, that it has to be re-examined every generation or so. And we have to make everything new again. That's how literature stays alive. It never remains confined to a particular historical moment. If it's not also contemporary for us, it perishes. And so Shakespeare and Cervantes in particular have a long history of being reinvented for every generation up to the present. In the early 20th century, when questions of Spanish national identity were in the forefront of the minds of Spanish intellectuals, many of them turned to Don Quixote, for instance, as an example of something touching the Spanish national character in the 20th century. And for Shakespeare, of course, we know that many of the most compelling productions of Shakespeare in recent years are the ones that managed to treat him as a contemporary writer, set the plays in moments remote from Elizabethan England or whatever period they are originally set in, but put them in the modern world in some fashion. And this is the way we work with great literature, and it stays alive to us because we always want to make it contemporary again. I think that we don't have a choice with these writers. They are both of their moment, and they are of our moment too.
One element that's often pointed out as something that unites or that connects these two figures, or the way they overlap, is that Don Quixote, in a way, is enacting Shakespeare's famous line from As You Like It, all the world's stage and all the men and women merely players. Quixote, of course, takes on a new identity. He becomes this knight and thus somehow he displays a very complex dynamics that is at the base of our identities to this day. That's what the critics have said, that we all try to leave behind the undesired identity and take on new, more appealing and more desirable ones. So we are all Quixotes when we look in the mirror. Would you agree?
Well, there is a romantic view of Don Quixote that he is a sort of paradigmatic figure for the way that we all harbor romantic illusions about ourselves. And there's something noble and even heroic about his doomed attempt to represent himself as a knight. Like a lot of romantic views of past literature, I tend to think that one is imposed from the future without enough historical context. My own personal view is that readers of his own moment, Don Quixote is meant to be more ridiculous than that. I think most readers of his time would consider him to be a fool. Now, of course, even fools say a lot of intelligent things from time to time and model behaviors that we might take seriously from time to time. So he's not completely beyond redemption. But I think for the most part, he's meant to demonstrate the perils of not knowing how to read.
And Cervantes's intention was also to amuse his readers. And that's why his book sold, became, it was practically the first ever bestseller.
Absolutely. It's the funniest book. It's still the funniest book in the world, in my opinion. At a moment in which, for writers like Shakespeare and Cervantes, it's important to have the kind of readers, to have readers who understand what they're trying to do, to have the kind of readers that can meet their works in terms of their genre, in terms of their intention, in terms of their outlook. Readers who will understand how to take them, not take them too literally, not read them allegorically. Readers who will understand what they're trying to do. I think Don Quixote exists in part in order to demonstrate the perils of bad reading, and that's what makes him so funny for his contemporaneous audience, is that he's they know from their own experience the difficulties of reading correctly, and so he's constantly modeling misreading in ways that the audience will find amusing.
But with this huge universal or timeless appeal that and constant reinvention of these authors and these texts, is it at all possible to think about what the authors and their texts meant in their respective cultural contexts? Do we have to have some specific academic methodology to unpack their intentions? Or what kind of intervention were they making or in the cultural and social atmosphere of their times? Or what were they actually trying to do with their texts in their respective contexts? How are we to reconstruct this context? Is it only something that academics can do with their extensive knowledge, or can regular reader also try to understand that too?
I think we can understand the intentions and the purposes of past literature by putting it in its context. If you just pick up Don Quixote or one of Shakespeare's plays such as Hamlet and you read it all by itself and you try to ask yourself, what is this poet or this playwright or in this novelist trying to do in his context? What issues is he responding to? Who is he in dialogue with? Who is he in conversation with? It's very hard to do that in isolation for the average reader. But if you read more and you start to read, say, not only Don Quixote, but some of Cervantes' other works, and you read around in Shakespeare's plays, you read the tragedies, the comedies, the histories, and so forth, and you read a little bit of their contemporaries, which is, after all, what scholars do. We read everything from the period, everything that survives, so we try to get a sense of the whole context around these figures. When you do that, you start to understand what they're trying to do because you can place them. You can encounter the things that they are trying to get away from. You can encounter the works that they are making fun of, the ones that seem ridiculous to them. You can just assemble a context around them. I think anybody can do that. I don't think one has to be a scholar, but one does have to be willing to read beyond the few great texts that everybody agrees on. And frankly, you have to be willing to read things that aren't so great. You know, you have to be willing to read things that are important to the time, that are sort of the standard or average things of the time, as opposed to great works that have transcended their moment, like many of those by Shakespeare and Cervantes. You have to read their lesser contemporaries. But when you do that, you can assemble a better sense of what it is that they're trying to do. Then they do have a context.
What you do so wonderfully in your book. But before we get to it, I have a couple more questions. One thing you hear about them, as you also pointed out at the beginning of the interview, is that they are quintessentially modern, how much we try to conceptualize them in their context. Terms Shakespearean and Quixotic are very recognizable in Shakespearean, meaning something great and tragic and important and quixotic as romantic and absurd and impulsive. And characters, too, have become archetypes, catch names. The Macbeths are the power and ambition, Othello, the jailer's lover, and so on and so forth. Romeo and Juliet, the young love, and Lear, aging, neglect, so on and so forth. The idea that these writers are modern and are being reinvented in every age is, of course, very well known. It's a cliche of its own. But one element that's pointed out, critics have said, since their characters have come to define this vocabulary and thinking in the modern age, in our age as well, can we say that they also actually somehow influence our times, make us think or act according to those categories?
I think true that one of the features of survival of both Shakespeare and Cervantes is that they've given us paradigms for thinking about human behavior and for thinking about the ways that people operate in the world and think. And so when we use terms like something is quixotic or something is Shakespearean, we are referring back to features of these plays and these novels that somehow make sense for us in the modern world. I think that in context, those terms, that is, when you take them back to their historical moment and you think about the novels and the plays themselves, I think those terms are not that useful because they mean too many things. You know, it's a tautology to say Don Quixote himself is quixotic. It becomes meaningful when you apply that term to somebody else, and people do. And likewise, when we're encountering somebody's downfall in the political world and we say this is a Shakespearean tragedy. It's a way of keeping those works alive, I suppose. I think on close examination, it actually turns out not to mean very much.
Don Quixote is regarded as the first novel, as we all know. What does it actually mean, first novel, in terms of form and genre? And what can be said of the fact that the founding father of contemporary fiction or novel was not some scholar in the Renaissance, but he was famously, as we know, a soldier, a prisoner, adventurer, Cervantes himself?
Don Quixote is commonly referred to as the first novel because it is the first work of, first of all, prose fiction at a time in which much fiction was still written in verse. It's the first work of prose fiction that captures the tension between a kind of romance view of the world, by which I mean the kind of magical view of the world populated by heroes, with including the supernatural, the kind of fiction that Don Quixote is ridiculing, that is the kind of chivalric fiction involving knights and ladies, damsels in distress, and so forth.
So in his context, that's exactly what he's doing. He's ridiculing or attacking the established genres at the time.
Exactly. And so on the one hand, there is that dimension of the book because that's what Don Quixote himself is reading and referring to. On the other hand, the book captures the tension between that and the way that people actually live in Cervantes' own society. So the first time that Don Quixote goes to a hotel and tries to leave in the morning without paying, and the innkeeper says, "Here's your bill," and Quixote says, "In none of my books have I ever seen a knight pay when he leaves the castle in the morning." And the innkeeper says, "Well, in this castle you're paying me because I'm an innkeeper and here's the bill." When you have those moments from very early on in part one of Don Quixote, what Cervantes is doing to the delight of his audience is capturing the fact that up until this point there really isn't a kind of fiction that represents that modern experience of what it is to live as an everyday person in the world of modernity. And to have the constant comparison, really the conversation that goes on throughout the book between the way fiction has traditionally represented the world and the way that a new kind of fiction represents people's actual recognizable reality, that was brand new. And nobody had ever done that before. And in doing so, not only did Cervantes give us the first modern novel, but he also pretty much killed that kind of romance fiction, chivalric fiction, for a long time afterwards, because it was very hard to go back to reading it again after people had experienced it in the context of Don Quixote. So the fact that we call it the first novel is really based on that tension between this view of romance fiction with knights and ladies and so forth, and the beginnings of what, it's a little too early to use the term, but what we would call realism. The tension between those two things is the basis of the modern novel, and then eventually, of course, gives us the realist novel and so forth.
Shakespeare and Cervantes are regarded as two giants, but it's also a fact that Shakespeare somehow has overshadowed. Cervantes is more, still a little bit more celebrated within Spanish-speaking world. We know that Borges was obsessed with him. We know what Gabriel Garcia Marquez was saying about the novel, that it was everything that every novelist tried to do ever since. While Shakespeare is universal. You can find his place, I suppose, in every part of the world, and is much more well-known and has this universalist ethos. Why do you think that happened? Is this linguistic differences, or do they have to do also with the position of England or Britain as opposed to Spain, Britain being more powerful after its maybe colonial expansion that followed Shakespeare's time?
Mm-hmm. Well, the comparison between Shakespeare and Cervantes in terms of their subsequent appeal and the ways in which they are revived differently around the world is a complicated one, I think. On one level, you could simply say the universality of Cervantes is mostly tied up in Don Quixote himself. I mean, it really doesn't extend to his plays. He was a playwright, although he wrote a number of other fictions that are wonderful. Those tend not to be the ones we talk about when we talk about the universal importance and the trans-historical importance of Cervantes. We're really talking usually about Don Quixote. In Shakespeare's case, though, he gave us a variety of plays that are able to be staged in a lot of different ways, and the plays themselves are really different among themselves. They're comedies, histories, tragedies set in a variety of settings with character, a whole army of characters that we use as examples for different kinds of human behavior and characters that we think of as different representative types of their moment, from Hamlet to Falstaff to Shylock and so forth. So in that sense, Shakespeare just gives us a much more varied population and a more different takes on his contemporary world than Cervantes does. So I think that that's a big part of it. I also think, though, that the rise of Shakespeare as the paradigmatic modern author of the Renaissance has a lot to do with the rise of English as a de facto world language. I think that because Spanish, despite the fact that it's spoken by an enormous population all over the world, I think that Spanish has not enjoyed that kind of status as a near universal second language that English has in the second half of the 20th century and up to our own time. And I think that the rise of what I would call the Shakespeare industry, which is the cultural forces that make it possible for you to see a Shakespeare play anywhere in the world at any moment, and that bring about translations of Shakespeare's work into every imaginable language, that to me really has a great deal to do with that rise of English in the second half of the 20th century. I think it's coincident with it. In a way, it's sort of an extension of it. It's the artistic extension of it into the world of aesthetics. In that sense, they're not really comparable, because Shakespeare his reputation is riding forces that are much bigger than his own work. They are forces in our own modern world. And Cervantes is not riding those forces. He's, if anything, he's tied to the fortunes of the novel, which is a different set of resources and also a different set of advantages, frankly, than Shakespeare has, because many more people read novels than read plays in the modern world. Many people think of the novel as the expression of literature in the modern world. So in a way, Cervantes has other advantages. But that linguistic difference, the question of that one is writing in English and one is writing in Spanish, I think is because of the way the modern world has evolved, has made a difference in their reputations and their survival.
One respected Shakespeare scholar, Marjorie Garber, in one of her books, draws upon Michel Foucault's concept of initiators of discursive practices. With Foucault, this means an author that emerged in the 19th century Europe, the Freud, for example, or Marx, or even Saussure. These are figures who invented a way of thinking about mankind and language and consciousness, and the discourses they initiated shaped thinking of future generations. And this is, of course, not the same as great literary author or founders of science or authors of canonical religious texts and so on. Garber argues that Shakespeare, in fact, was both. He was a great literary author and an initiator of discursive practices. And this is why he's so modern. Would you agree with this assessment? And would you say the same applies to Cervantes as well? That they changed the paradigm so much that the future generations are marked with their discursive practices?
I tend to think that both Shakespeare and Cervantes are paradigm breakers who give us new ways to think, give us new ways to represent the world. In a way, that's what we're saying when we say that they invent the novel or that they create these transcendent characters such as Hamlet. If you peel back the kind of claim that's being made there, what we're really talking about is the fact that they represent thought in ways that are unprecedented for their time. And modern scholars, such as Marjorie Garber and others, give those innovations names, and by applying them to thinkers in our world, say, 20th and 21st century thinkers and say, well, this represents, this is like Freud, or this is like Michel Foucault, or this is like some other figure that we recognize as an important thinker in the modern world. And we can apply those modern thinkers back to Shakespeare and Cervantes in order to help us understand what they're doing. That makes a lot of sense. It depends on what question you're looking at. If it's epistemology, maybe we're talking about Michel Foucault. If it's politics, maybe we're talking about somebody else from the modern age. If it's psychoanalysis, maybe it's Freud. But the fundamental point here is that they are responsible. Both writers are responsible for deep-seated changes in the ways that people think. They represent how to think about the world in ways that come to be modern.
Now, to turn to your book entitled Five Words, Critical Semantics in the Age of Shakespeare and Cervantes, and you, in the introduction, call it an experiment in tracing some worldviews of early modern Europe and the Americas through words that you say were in action during the 16th century and remain available today. These are invention, language, resistance, blood, and world. Can you tell us a little bit about your project in more detail and explain the methodological ways in which you trace the history of these concepts throughout the century and in the texts of these writers, and what can development or the history, intellectual history of these concepts tell us?
Well, I wrote my book Five Words because I was interested in developing a fresh way of describing the period, the Renaissance. Basically the 16th century, from a few years before the 16th century and into a little bit into the 17th century, but basically the long 16th century. I was interested in finding fresh ways of describing that long moment, not through the careers of particular writers or through the histories of emerging literary genres or through the historical context of the moment, but through something different. I thought, what if one tried to deduce the features of the period through just a handful of words? And in my field, which is in literary studies, there's a long tradition of talking about past moments through what we call keywords, that is, words that carry a lot of ideological charge in their moment. So keywords in the Renaissance are words like virtue, sovereignty, human, words that emerge in the period and words that start to mean something different in the period because they are the words that major thinkers of the period are constantly discussing.
And you didn't choose those words. You chose completely different words.
I didn't want to do it with keywords. Yeah, I, as I say in the introduction to the book, it's a different project to talk about the period through keywords. But I thought I wanted to talk about the period through what I call working words, or words that people are using a lot and that might mean too many things. Ordinary people are not. In the Renaissance, they're not walking around talking about sovereignty. Intellectuals are. But ordinary people in the Renaissance are talking about blood, and they're talking about language. And so I wanted to choose words that had that kind of everyday character to them, and where I would have to admit to myself that before I wrote a chapter on any one of these words, blood or invention or language, that I wouldn't know what the story was going to be. That's very different from writing a chapter on the emergence of the word human or something in the period, where, frankly, I do know what the story is going to be before I write that chapter. And and also, many other scholars in the field could write that chapter just as well as I could. But I thought, I don't want to write that kind of book. I want to write something where I don't really know what the answer is going to be, and I have to just immerse myself in rereading tremendous amount of material from the period, which is now more possible than ever because of the availability of digital resources. So many things have been digitized that one can read much more widely than say, a generation ago. And one can look for words, search for words in ways that you couldn't before. So I basically immersed myself in these five words over a period of some years and then saw what story emerged about them in each case. And, each chapter offers a kind of anecdote about what happens, how the word becomes modern over the course of the period, how it comes to mean different things. For example, simple example would be the fact that the word world over the course of the period in most European vernaculars, gains the sense that it's possible for world to be plural, whereas at the beginning of the period, when most people use the word world, they tend to use it in the medieval sense of, like, the way we would use universe, like something of which there's only one, the sum total of everything that there is, the world. And
this all happens within the course of one century.
Yeah. But by the end of the century, more or less, you have lots of people speaking about using the word world in the way that we would say, we would recognize, where I would say, you have your world, I have my world, welcome to my world, let me tell you about my world, and so on, where worlds are not only plural, but discrete, individual. And so the book is in, interested in asking questions like that about each of the five words. How do they change over the course of the period? How can we see those changes reflected in literature? Because my sense, which was corroborated over the course of writing the book, is that one of the reasons that we consider great writers great is that they are precisely those people in a culture who are drawn to these kinds of instabilities. They don't run away from words that are undergoing changes. They run toward them, and they participate in making the changes. And great works of literature are usually in the forefront of rethinking the meaning of a word. That's one of the things that we may not notice it, but that's one of the things that is happening when we encounter a work of literature, that we realize that it is changing the way we use the language itself, even at the level of words. So I wrote it with those goals in mind.